This is CliffCentral.com.
I'm very happy to welcome to the studio someone who I think will give us all a good deal of perspective when it comes to what's likely to happen in the next election here in South Africa. Certainly from the point of view of what the trends are in Coalition Country, and that's the title of his book, Coalition Country, South Africa After the ANC. I mean, that's a hell of a title, Dr. Leon Schreiber, to start with. It's very nice to see you. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me, Gareth. And indeed, it is a hell of a title.
Yeah, you're being very provocative, aren't you?
Yeah, well, I guess it goes with trying to sell books, so I'll be honest about that. But that's what the argument boils down to, hey?
Well, South Africa post the ANC is a big claim to make, because I don't think the ANC is dead yet, and who knows how badly the DA and EFF can injure themselves.
Yeah, so I think the title, in a way, refers to the ANC as the sort of single dominant party that we've known. So the paradigm of having single party dominance is what I refer to in the title. So after the ANC is the right way to look at it, because the ANC will not be able, you know, once it loses its 50% majorities, it's not able to be the old ANC that we used to know. It will be forced into compromises and will become one among a set of equals.
Maybe sort of even accountability.
Well, yeah, I think that is something that's possible. It's certainly something built into the coalition system to some extent. And I will get into some of the ways in which you can go around
that. It might not be too much to ask, but you've written this book, which is, it's a solid piece of work. You've put a lot of effort into figuring out exactly what the numbers are in every place and kind of who's involved where and who the personalities are behind each of these things. I mean, it really requires an enormous amount of research. This is not you writing an opinion piece on what you think is going to happen.
No, I mean, it was something that I tried to do quite systematically and get a bit behind the noise, look at some of the structural trends we're seeing, and maybe I'll touch on a couple of those that go beyond the sort of sentiment, which, as we've seen, is something that can shift almost on a daily basis now. So a couple of structural things that I point out in the book. First of all, just the distribution of people in South Africa. So, you know, Gauteng and the Western Cape together account for, you know, in the high 30s percentage-wise of South Africa's population. As we know, these are urban centers where the resistance against the ANC has been sort of the most intense. And we know in 2016, the ANC actually got 46% in Gauteng already. So just something like urbanization rate, South Africa is 65% urban at this point compared to 50% in 1994. The growth of the black middle class, for example, as well, something that creates a different set of challenges. We know from international experience that a more urban middle class society tends to have different expectations. They care more about corruption, about problems with education. They care more about life as it remains happening than people sort of in rural areas who are just trying to get by on a daily basis. And I think so it's no coincidence that the ANC has become more of a rural party. We've certainly seen sort of the opposition gaining in urban centers and the ANC's strongholds really moving to the rural areas.
All right, so number one then is the distribution of population in this rural versus urban.
I think that's one part
dichotomy,
of it.
Dichotomy, right?
I think probably the economic side is the other big part here. Mm. So we all know the challenge that is faced by Cyril Ramaphosa, and as he tries to steady the ship economically. We just had the GDP figures coming out saying that the economy contracted by 2.2% in the first quarter.
And the majority of that contraction is in manufacturing, mining, and farming, obviously.
Right. I mean, so I think we've run into the reality of economics to some extent.
And we've run into the direct result of what happens when you start to talk about expropriation and property rights being in some way infringed.
Yeah, I mean, platitudes saying, oh, please keep investing, we won't harm the economy.
Absolute bullshit compared to...
It just doesn't mean anything for someone making an investment decision. So, you know, you combine that, the debt crisis is something else I talk about in the book. I mean, the explosion of the public sector under Jacob Zuma, we now have 2.7 million people working in the public sector in South Africa.
And they're asking for 10% increases every year.
Yeah, and their productivity, if you look at a global scale, it's nowhere near a justification for having such a big public sector. And spending, you know, we're getting close to spending 50% of our wage bill on a public sector that's not productive. So these are structural issues that have been, you know, there's one graph in the book where I basically map, you know, the public expenditure over the past decade, and you can just see it exploding from like 30% to the level where we're soon probably reach the 50% threshold. And we heard in the last couple of days that Eskom is refusing to give any wage increases this year, which is a sensible thing to do and which is basically the only option they have because there is no money left. But in reaction, we've already seen the labor union saying, you know, we're not happy with this. We demand the 10% we got used to over the last couple of years. So even the threat of a very unhappy labor sector, a very unhappy Kassar to SAFTU that's come up as a competition. So all these economic structural factors, you know, and then not even to mention the downgrading of our credit ratings over the last couple of years, make it very, very, very unlikely that the ANC is going to be able to significantly right the ship even as soon as 2019.
All right. So before we get into the specifics of this, because you've already taken us in this direction, and there are a couple of things I just want to set for everybody who's listening to kind of understand the context of this too, is that you... you've been looking at this stuff for a long time. Your background is that you have been a senior research specialist at Princeton University in the U.S. You were at the University Innovation for Successful Societies. So you actually looked at what a really good future society should look like. I mean, this is the stuff I really want to talk to you about. I could give a shit about the ANC or the DA or the EFF. I really don't care. The other thing that you did is you got a PhD in political science in Germany. So you've had the ability to compare political systems of all kinds.
Yeah.
And then obviously in this country, you've been looking at this stuff for a long time, South African Journal of Political Studies, Institutions and Political Change, the Child Support Grant. You've looked at all kinds of things, and you continue to write actively. It's not just books, but you blog, you do op-eds, you write for the Sunday newspapers, and you're a political analyst on a number of television programs and others.
Yeah. So let me congratulate you on your research, first of all.
No, well, I think it's important for people to know that you're not just a guy who's thumb-sucking like everybody else in South Africa when it comes to politics. Oh, my opinion is.
Right.
You know, this is the kind of information that I think is valuable to people who do want to sound informed, but who really aren't. I mean, I often, you know, try to read as much as possible. I try to tap the brains of people like you so that I can have some idea of what makes sense, and then try to construct a reality of my own. But the difficult thing about this is that it actually requires a huge amount of time and effort and qualification and experience. And that's why I wanted to talk to you. So let's start off with where you think we're at in the first few months of Cyril Ramaphosa's presidency, how badly damaged the system is economically, socially, politically. And then we can look at the political numbers and talk more about kind of whether or not coalitions are things that we can manage in this country, because we're so tribal in so many ways.
Yeah. If you don't mind, I just want to make one point that really sort of goes with what you just said about being informed. So a topic which, if you say the word, most people's eyes glaze over is the electoral system. And that's where the story begins in any democratic country.
Okay, so let's start there.
If you don't mind, I think it's, you know.
Okay, let's start with that. We have a party system where you vote for a party.
Right.
We don't have a separate presidential and party election. You vote for the party elects the president.
That's right.
And we don't have a constituency-based system, so your ward councillor or your municipal manager or your mayor or any of those people are not chosen by you. They're chosen from the top down.
Yeah, and especially in the provincial and the national levels. But so the key difference here is that you can either adopt the kind of constituency-based winner-take-all system that countries like the US, like the UK have traditionally had, and that many of our African neighbors have as well. So in that case, you do have the direct link. But the challenge with the constituency system, if you have a pure one, is that you can end up with a very skewed outcome, a disproportional outcome, because you just need to get more than your opponent in any given district, and then you go to parliament.
Mm-hmm.
So you can get 35%. As long as it's more than the other people competing in this district, you are elected.
Yeah.
So South Africa made a conscious choice in the 90s to not go with this system. There was evidence that in African states that were highly divided, having a winner-take-all where one group gets to totally dominate the other through disproportional election results is not a good idea. And learning from the experience of places like Germany and other societies that went the other way with proportional representation, that's what South Africa ended up adopting. And it was, I want to emphasize, it was a non-partisan decision. The ANC, the NP, the DP at that time, everyone agreed.
Yeah, but it was a party. idea. And the parties were the ones who were, who were the signatories.
But you don't necessarily need to link the closed list party system with proportionality.
Okay, so theoretically now.
Right.
Let's get into the heavy stuff straight away. Do
Happy
you
to
think
do that.
That the party system is still the best way to administer?
I think the best way to, the best possible electoral system that's ever been invented is what the Germans do. They have what you call mixed party proportionality. Mixed member proportionality.
How does that work?
So what it means is, I'm going to try to get this right now. You have 200 geographic constituencies in Germany. So if you live in city A or region A, you will elect one person who goes to the national parliament.
Mm-hmm.
So that's 200 representatives that are elected based on the winner-take-all model.
Right.
So that will produce a certain kind of split between the parties. But aside from your direct vote, you also get a vote for a party, where they have the list system that South Africa has.
Hmm.
So the reason for this dual approach is precisely because, let's say Party A gets 30% of the votes in the direct election.
Mm-hmm.
But because of the way that you don't have to, you don't need to get 50%, they may get 60% of the representatives. So there's a total mismatch between the 30% of people who actually voted for that party and the 60% of representatives that they send to parliament.
Mm-hmm.
But that's where the list comes in. So then, because of this mismatch, they use the candidates on the list to top up the other party's representatives until you reach a nationally proportional outcome.
To the tune of what, another 200?
Actually, there's no roof on it.
Oh,
that's interesting. So it can fluctuate, but usually it's around between 400 and 500 representatives.
So those 400 or 500 people then are in the Bundesrat, and that's made up of constituency-elected people and party-list-elected
exactly.
people.
Exactly. So you'll have so roughly a halfway split.
You're saying we need a mix. Like
I think
that.
It's the ideal. Yeah, I think South Africa desperately needs some kind of direct accountability. So adding some geographic constituencies alongside our party list system, I think would make a big difference. And also, you know, a country like the Netherlands also has a list system, but it's an open list.
Yeah.
So that's the other thing that you can tweak here. We have a closed list system which gives the political leadership total control over who makes it onto the list. But in a place like the Netherlands, if 30,000 people vote for a specific candidate, then they automatically get onto that party's list.
Right.
So it gives you – so there's a lot of leeway, you know,
okay.
that for us
so
to look at this.
Let's just also discuss, what are the benefits to a party system and what are the obvious problems that we're experiencing as a result of party dominance in the electoral system?
So I think the big benefit – first of all, to a proportional system, is that it is proportional. So we have a very low threshold. You need 40,000 votes roughly to get one seat in parliament, which theoretically makes it very accessible to anyone who has any kind of gripe in the country to make it into the national parliament. So that's a big advantage if you're talking about representativity.
That's how we end up with Cope and Hung and these
So the
people,
Germans,
right?
For example, you need at least 5% of the national vote before you get even one seat.
Whew.
So South Africa has a very, very low threshold.
Okay.
So that's one, I think, arguably an advantage. Some people may disagree, but I think it is. The other thing is, because everything is so proportional, there's no chance that one party can get 60% of seats in parliament, even though they only got 40% of the national vote. Now, this thing can happen in the UK, it can happen in France, it can happen in the US. South Africa's system doesn't make it possible. So to put it very bluntly, if we had adopted a pure winner-take-all system in 1994, about 80% of our parliamentarians would have been from the ANC, and about 80% of them would have been black.
Yeah.
So there would have been a very strong tendency against having
a lot of people would
minority
say
the, voices.
A lot of people would say though that that would be the certainly at that stage the demographics and the makeup of the country. So,
right, but it doesn't mirror the voters' preferences.
Right.
Right, because the ANC got 62% of the countrywide vote, but they would have ended up with something like 80% of the seats in parliament.
Okay. Yeah. All right, so all those people who keep mulling on about how great a constituency-based system, winner-take-all, would be, actually haven't done the research.
There's a trade-off, yeah. And I think you need to look at a mixed system if you really want to get it right.
All right. Again, proving the point that people don't do their research. Well, this is why we have people like you around, Dion. All right. Now, what is the advantage to having the system that you're proposing? Not only in terms of the numbers, but how do you think that affects policy making? How do you think it affects service delivery, accountability?
So the remedy or the things that potentially need to be remedied in South Africa's system is not the proportionality.
Yeah.
The fact that we have perfect proportionality is the great strength of our system. what would need some attention, I think, is exactly the closed list approach. So opening up either the list process to some kind of input directly from voters, nominating the people who they think should go to parliament, or potentially adopting the kind of mixed approach, which, by the way, is not a new idea. Frederik van Zyl-Slabbert, in his report in the early 2000s, suggested exactly this, a mixed member system.
Okay. He was ahead of his time, that man.
He very much was, and the Mbeki government just ignored it, essentially. Yeah. The reasons for that I'm not sure about as we sit here. But so, you know, these proposals and these issues have been floating around, but I think one of the difficulties is just such a hard topic for people to really engage in. But once you understand it, it's clear how important it becomes, because it can totally swing, you know, the outcome of any given election if you just slightly modify the system.
All right. You and the book have gone into quite a strategic discussion of what the various political parties are up to at the moment, where they're positioned, where they have strengths and weaknesses. I reckon that a large part of your market for this book is going to be the parties themselves, trying to see where they can jockey for position in various places. Let's look at the recent history of where the parties are and what their opportunities and threats are.
Yeah.
Let's start with the ANC.
Okay. Are we talking about coalition specifically?
Yeah.
Or taking
let's talk provincial politics. Right. Let's talk municipal even, yeah, where it's relevant.
Yeah.
And then look at national.
So if we begin with the ANC, until very recently, I would say the ANC was very far behind the curve. In a way, it's understandable that if you...
You mean in terms of having any strategy at all?
Being prepared for the coalition era,
right,
let's put it like that.
Okay.
If you're used to being a party which thinks that it will rule until Jesus comes, it breeds a certain kind of arrogance. It breeds a certain attitude towards opposition, mm-hmm, where you see them as, you know, little Jack Russells that are just nipping at your heels, rather than the potential partners that they are in the kind of framework we actually have.
And it's a little disrespectful of the electorate.
Yeah, it is, because, you know, it supposes that the electorate can only have one preference, and any other kind of preference is not valid somehow. So then in late 2017, we had this, I think, very revealing statement from Natim Tetwa saying that any suggestion that the ANC needs to prepare for coalitions, now keep in mind this is after they already lost cities to coalitions in 2016, would be a defeatist thing to do. And that really sent the alarm bells ringing in my mind. But to their credit, in recent months, I think after Ramaphosa's come in, there has been a softening of this.
ANC's learnt about coalitions within its own party at the conference at Nazareth. They've had to, I mean, even Jessie Duarte, you can never believe, because she has two forked tongues in every one of her seven mouths. And when Jessie Duarte says, "This is a coalition ANC," mm-hmm, as in it's an ANC. That's what she said at a press conference not so long ago, that this is not a Jacob Zuma or a Cyril Ramaphosa ANC. It's combination of both. What essentially they're admitting to is that coalition has now become part of their vocabulary.
That's right. But that's a key shift. I mean, imagine 10 years ago suggesting anything of the sort.
There would have been denials about any kind of faction, which we heard.
Yeah.
We heard those denials just prior to the December conference.
The other thing, though, that I think many listeners may not know about is that there was recently an event in Cape Town organized by Professor Nick Callan from the University of Cape Town, mm-hmm, where he brought together German political leaders from across the spectrum, from six different parties, and actually invited South African political leaders from across the spectrum. The EFF was the only one who chose not to attend.
Mm-hmm.
But you had very senior leaders from different parties there, including Jackson Mthembu from the ANC. And to me, that suggested a new kind, you know, we're not talking about defeatism anymore. I think there's been a realization in the ANC, and actually a realization which lines up perfectly with the book, that coalitions are here to stay.
And in your book, you indicate this without being forceful about it, that it is a natural state of progress for this to end up being the balance of power in a state which is maturing.
So I open up the book by saying that out of the 78 democracies in the world, there's only three that have had one party in power for longer than the ANC in South Africa. And the amazing thing is, since the book has come out, there's only two left, because Malaysia's longtime dominant party lost an election.
Right.
So it's an exceptional, it's an absolutely unique story in South Africa, that you have a an electoral system that is completely geared towards coalitions that ends up with a one-party hegemony for almost a quarter of a century. And that goes back to the ANC's, you know, the liberation narrative, the legitimacy that the party enjoyed. So in a little bit of theoretical terms, the way I see it is that the agency of voters, the preference was so strong for the ANC that they were able to overrule the tendencies of the structure of the electoral system. But the question from day one, actually, has always been, when will the structure reassert itself? Agency cannot, because we live in a dynamic world where things change and where you eventually elect Jacob Zuma as president and the economy eventually implodes, etc.
Right.
The preferences will change, but what doesn't change is the structure. And my suggestion is that we're coming very close to the moment where that structure will become the dominant force in our society. And that moment, quite simply, is whether it's at a municipality, a province, or at national level, wherever the ANC drops below 50%, it's not that we will then get a new party who somehow becomes dominant and is a one-party government. We will get a totally different kind of government that's premised on coalitions.
So there are three kinds of coalitions that we can get into in a minute or two, but I want to also talk specifics geographically and all the rest of it.
Right.
There could be ANC-DA coalitions, there could be ANC-EFF coalitions, and there could be DA-EFF coalitions. Yep. The last mentioned, we've already seen in Johannesburg, less successfully in Nelson Mandela Bay, and in Tswane they seem to be holding up also,
yeah,
but very much by, you know, a thread. We haven't seen the ANC ally with anyone yet in order to do this, or have we?
In Ekurhuleni, in the East Rand, they have, with the AIC, I think, is the big partner there. But I think the broader point that you're touching on there is that one of the big things that will change is that the composition of our governments will once we enter this era quite properly, the composition of our governments will become a highly dynamic thing.
Yeah, it won't be just ANC cadre deployment.
And you could very easily live in a municipality that's run by the DA and the ANC, but within a province that's run by COPE, the EFF, and the DA,
yeah,
and in a country where there's an IFP-ANC coalition. That's the kind of dynamism, and these things, so if you look at it from a kind of game theoretical point of view, the coalition scenario is an iterative game. It's not something that happens once, unlike under the dominant party regime. You have one election result, mm-hmm, where there's one party that then knows it's in charge for 5 years. Because it's an iterative game, every move that a coalition makes saying, okay, the DA decides we're going with the EFF today, that sends a signal to its partners that we don't want you today. And then the partners can sort of mobilize, regroup, try to take the EFF away, and that influences sort of the next composition, yeah, of the government.
And then the different layers of government influence each other.
It's going to become a hectic and a chaotic thing if we don't start wrapping our heads around it.
But it's good.
I think
because,
so.
Because ultimately these guys are on their toes the whole time. They can never settle in and think, oh, well, we're here for 4 or 5 years and we can just chill.
That's the key difference. But I would add that although I personally am optimistic, I mean, there is some data. There are reasons to be optimistic. I'll give you a couple maybe very quickly about coalitions.
Mm-hmm.
So Germany is the quintessential example of a bombed-out society in 1945. West Germany has had unbroken coalition government since 1945 in different configurations. And they've built one of the most successful countries in the world. And not only that, they also managed to uplift East Germany after 1990 under the same coalition model.
Right.
But it goes beyond. And I mean, I think the statistic is since 1945, only 12% of governments in Europe have not been coalitions. So a big part of the world, you know, if you give this book to someone in the Netherlands or in Germany, they say, what's new about this? This is our life. But outside Europe, there are also examples. India is a big one that people often don't quite recognize. India's economic growth since they got unbroken coalition governments in 1990 until today, economic growth has averaged 6.6% compared to about 4 or even less than that, 3.8% in the 25 years before that when India's version of the ANC was in charge on its own. So we have a couple of examples that suggest and there's a famous book by a political scientist called Arend Leipart, where it's called Patterns of Democracy.
That's an interesting name.
where he basically makes the argument quite forcefully that these kind of coalition societies force compromises that make progress possible, whereas if you have one party domination in divided societies, you end up with the kind of problems that South Africa is experiencing today. So that's where I think a lot of the optimism comes from. But to be fair and to be honest, There are problems, especially in a society that is so used to one-party dominance. I mean, yeah. It's been 70 years that we've had the National Party first, and now we've had the ANC in single-handed total control of South Africa. And as you may know, South Africans have certainly a preference for the strongman politics. We see it with Ramaphosa.
Well, we even had it under the old National Party.
It's not a new thing.
You sketch that very well in the book, too. You say that they were there for 46 years.
Right, exactly. Unbroken.
Unbroken chain of command.
And with no need for anyone to govern with in a coalition of any sort. So.
But the world has changed. And we would imagine, I think, in South Africa that, you know, populations can't be led by the nose like they once were. There are differences between and within groups that make it impossible for people to blanket describe or appeal to them. And I think those are all things that have to do with that maturity as well.
I think so, yeah. I mean, the maturity, I would argue, goes along with things like urbanization, with the growth of a middle class. These things are all connected in some way. But yes, that's the other sticking point, I guess, when I speak with people who don't like this idea. You know, a couple of weeks ago in a bookshop, a guy said, no, this book is nonsense. We'll never allow the ANC to lose. I guess the difference I have with those people is that they don't quite realize how fundamentally South African politics have changed in the last decade.
Do you think ideology is still the most important factor of why people would vote for a particular party or why a certain party would try to legislate a certain way? Or has that changed?
You mean globally or in South Africa?
No, here, because we see service delivery protests that are inherently practical in their complaints. We see discussions around land and around mining and around very pragmatic things, in effect. And there is an ideological element even to those. But do you think pure ideology is still a part of this? I had a discussion with Justice Malala the other day about what liberal democracy means in the DA these days.
Yeah.
And whether identity politics isn't a more important thing. Hmm. And whether either of those matter to the average DA voter, or whether they just want the lights on, the water running, and the border demarcated.
Well, I think we're going to see a kind of a test of that in the Western Cape with the DA's base in the next election. My sense is, though, that South African politics have always been more about race than about ideology. Hmm. But I take your point, and I think it's true, that for the average voter, having... if such a thing exists, having someone doing the basics right is such an overwhelming concern in South Africa that in many ways it is different from countries like in Europe, where the challenge in many Western European countries is just to maintain a system that's basically been perfected as much as you can. South Africa is not near that. We are not sure whether our country will actually fail or whether it will succeed. So the day-to-day service issues, being a competent government, I think certainly should be more important, and we should be more pragmatic than just being ideologically focused. But I would wager an argument that says the outcome of the 2016 election, specifically in Gauteng, does suggest that there is an electorate of people who remain perhaps ANC in their hearts, but who have realized that the practical delivery issues, the broken roads, the sewage system that doesn't work, in many ways affects them much more personally than the ideology does. And I don't think we would have had opposition minority coalitions in charge of Johannesburg and Tshwane if there hadn't been that shift. And I think that's touching on exactly my point, that people don't realize how much the earth has actually moved under our feet in the last couple of years.
All right. How much of this is because Jacob Zuma did damage?
Well, Jacob Zuma couldn't have done all of it on his own, as much as he may have wanted to.
Let's say his administration.
Yeah. Well, I think it's probably his administration, which lasted for 8 years, I believe, was the thing that I think began to significantly tilt the scales. But in the book, I try to look at the reasons why the ANC is declining and why it's happening now, not 10 years ago. And what I conclude there is that you need two elements. You need a sort of a long run story. You need hard data that shows crime has increased over the last decade and more. corruption is front and center, and it has been front and center since the arms deal, since the Sarafina episode with Dlamini Zuma in the 90s.
You can almost say that the ANC never really had clean hands at any point.
I think it's fair to say that. So if you ask South Africans what they care about, they tell you they care about poverty, they care about crime, and they care about corruption. And if you look at these issues, there's a long trend of deterioration, which we all kind of know, but because we live in sort of snapshots and the media
and coverage the news cycle so fast.
Yeah, but if you look back, the data is there that there is an undoubted decline going back 10, 15 years. But then that's never enough. You need this decay to coalesce around something. And I think that's probably Zuma's contribution, if we want to call it that. Because Jacob Zuma gave us the trigger moments that were called Nkandla and state capture.
Yeah.
And even today, Cyril Ramaphosa's mission is to disassociate the ANC from those two terms. It informs everything he does. And it just reveals to you how closely that has been tied with the ANC now, in a way that goes far beyond Jacob Zuma. And every time someone mentions the name Mabuza, everyone thinks state capture.
Right.
And so when you combine a long-term trend with something that can focus the public mind, there's a reason we talk about the Rubicon speech, the assassination in Sarajevo, Watergate. These were not isolated crises. These were moments that encapsulated a long-term crisis that coalesced and focused the public mind and then led to massive change. So if you read any political history book and you hear things like 2 years before the election, there was a contentious leadership contest. The ruling party had been tied to some corruption like state capture. Mm-hmm. The economy was shrinking by 2.2% in the first quarter, just a year before the election. The public debt, everything we've spoken about. Usually when you turn the page in that book, the next page says, and the ruling party lost the next election. If we're talking about rebellions in the Northwest, if we're talking about Jacob Zuma on TV right now suggesting how KwaZulu-Natal is going to move away from the ANC, the next page of that story usually ends with some kind of rapture. It doesn't necessarily mean the ANC has to get less than 50% for a rapture to take place.
Yeah.
But I would argue losing Gauteng, losing Northwest,
it's a big move.
Those would be raptures which would make it clear to everyone that we are moving into a new era.
Let's talk about Joburg for a second, because it's a good case study and you've already raised it. Here we have a mayor who's from the DA, but essentially is a private businessman, a la Donald Trump, who's come in and used the DA for his own purposes because he wanted to achieve political office. And who knows, you know, there are those rare creatures, those very, very rare people who want to improve the world and have altruistic purposes. And often they're people who've made money and have done well for themselves and now want to do something more. Herman Mashaba is not popular, and he's trying to hold together a coalition in Joburg that looks very frayed at the edges. A lot of coalitions end up in that situation. And in Germany, too, you'll have experience and you'll have done the work in terms of figuring out just how gridlocked, deadlocked, and pointless some coalitions arrive us at a place of.
Yeah.
I'm a little less optimistic that all coalition is necessarily a recipe for practical service delivery, for quick decision making. You know, coalitions are complicated because anything by committee is bound to be a little bit messier.
Yeah.
So how do you feel about that in the context of Joburg? What do you think the chances are of the Mashaba municipality being able to pull off all of its very, very grand promises? And what are its major pitfalls and areas of threat?
In response, I would just say that I agree with you that there's nothing that says necessarily any coalition is somehow better than a single party government. I think that's probably taking it too far. But I think on average and over time, again, the iterative nature of coalitions probably leads to bigger benefits over time. But if you take an individual case like Johannesburg, I think it's great that we now have these case studies in South Africa that we as voters and as citizens can start thinking about before we cast our ballot next year. The one thing to point out immediately about both Tshwane and Johannesburg is that they are not formal majority coalitions. They are minority coalitions. The if I remember correctly, the DA controls about 34% of the seats in the Joburg Council. It has added a couple of small opposition parties, which give it around 40%, maybe 42%. But they don't have the crucial 50% in a formal coalition because the EFF made a strategic decision not to join this formal coalition. I would say that a lot of the deadlock, so recently the budget issue where the EFF blocked the budget, is in many ways more a reflection of one of the possibilities under a coalition scenario, which is minority government.
Right.
So the key thing there is that you as a party, as Herman Mashaba, you may lead the executive of the city. And certainly, especially at local level, it gives you a lot of power. I think that's probably the one thing that would make me swing a little bit favorable towards the argument that they may just achieve a lot of what they want, because at local level, mayors have huge powers.
Okay.
But even then, if you want to pass your budget, if you want to change anything about the tariffs, the rates, as we've seen all these examples in Joburg,
that's where it gets stuck.
That's where it gets stuck. And that's by definition how minority governments get stuck, because you only control 40% of the seats in the legislature. And to change anything, to pass your budget, you need 50% plus one. So here the bargaining comes in. Because there's no formal coalition that tells the EFF you must support the coalition's budget, they can block it as many times as they want. And obviously the ANC, as the opposition there, will block it as well. Now the negotiations and things like personal relationships between people like Herman Mashaba and Julius Malema come into the picture, because the DA coalition every time needs to convince the EFF or the ANC to give us some of your votes so we can pass our budget. So the deadlock of minority government is something that we're seeing playing out beautifully, sadly, in these cities. And my conclusion on that would actually be, we as voters need to look at that and say, are we actually satisfied with a situation where our political representatives are too cowardly to form a formal alliance and work together and say, in the interests of our voters, we're not going to have one foot in the door and one foot out of the door. We're going to make a formal agreement. We're going to get this thing done. I think strategically it was a brilliant move by the EFF, because they managed to disassociate themselves from the ANC and the DA. But I think practically what you point out right now is the limitation of minority government when you decide not to go all in on coalitions. And in my book, I think that I explore that scenario, and I would tell you that I think it's a very likely scenario in Gauteng, nationally, and in other provinces. Due to the polarization and the lack of cross-party relationships in South Africa, I think we're going to see a lot of minority governments unless we as voters start telling our representatives, when they come to our neighborhood or speak at a meeting, put up your hand and say, listen, it's all good that you have this vision, but we understand you're not going to get 50%. So tell us, what are the non-negotiables, and how prepared are you to form a formal coalition so that our life doesn't come to a halt because of your disagreement?
Yeah, we shouldn't be dictated to. We should be the ones making the dictation. All right. So how about if we take the example of the Government of National Unity? Because people forget, we have very short memories. Everybody goes, oh, 94, it was the ANC who won.
Yeah.
Yeah, they didn't. There was a Government of National Unity, which was obviously constitutionally provided for. It expired after a time, but there was Nelson Mandela, there was F.W. de Klerk, and there was Thabo Mbeki.
Right.
And the old National Party was still very much a part of our government going past 1994.
Right, and Buthelezi as well.
And Mangosuthu Buthelezi. Yeah. So what do we learn from that example?
Yeah, so I look at two case studies in the book with exactly that question. What is it that we – it's all good and well to talk about other countries, and there are certainly lessons we can take, not only from Europe, but from Kenya, from India. Mm. But I think we do have the luxurious position to have, I think, two brilliant examples of how coalitions can work and what their limitations are. So the GNU, the Government of National Unity, the ANC got 62% in that election. But because of the constitutional provisions that existed at the time, both the National Party and the IFP were entitled. It wasn't an option. They were entitled to be in cabinet. So we had a coalition government, which arguably and probably is the most – it governed the most productive period in South Africa's political history, because the current constitution was adopted under the GNU. The 11 different legal frameworks that existed for the homelands and for the republic were integrated into one.
Mm-hmm.
The public service became one. We created 9 new provinces. The constitutional court was created. If you look back at it, there's just no denial that at least from a productivity point of view, it was an exceptional period in our history.
In the executive, the legislature, and the judiciary.
That's exactly right. And I would argue that without some form of coalition consensus among the different parties, it would have been more difficult. It would have taken longer. So I think the GNU was a brilliant...
Also, people who were feeling excluded would have worked against the system.
And that's exactly why the provision was there, is to make sure that everyone has a stake in it. So overall, it is a glowing example, but it also reveals some of the problems. And one key difference between the kind of coalitions we have today and the GNU is precisely that, as you say, the ANC won. The ANC had more than 50%. So its coalition partners were not necessary fundamentally for it to be in power. So there could be accommodation among the different parties, but when the bottom line came, the ANC always had a built-in majority where they could go to parliament and they could pass abortion legislation even if their partners don't like it. That's what it came down to. The difference between the second example I use in the book, the Cape Town coalition in 2006, the difference between that with that one and with our current coalitions, no one has that 50% majority. No one has a built-in majority. So you need your partners not only to change legislation but even to remain in government. If they defect, you're out.
Yeah.
So Helen Ziller in 2006 became mayor of Cape Town, leading a 7-party coalition, which I think at the time everyone would have said this is absurd.
That sounds impossible to wrangle. She was a miracle worker.
It's an exceptional example, and I encourage everyone to read the book if only for that example. Because what the DA was able to do there is the ANC and the Independent Democrats thought that they had sealed the deal. And because they totally discounted even the possibility of a 7-party coalition, which would include the DA and all the very small local parties, they were completely surprised on the day of the vote, and Ziller became mayor by one vote. And so she led this coalition, which, if you imagine the vulnerability of your government with one seat majority, it means one person needs to defect, and the whole show starts over with the possibility that you're out. So they managed to keep that together, but it's so instructive because the kind of disagreements they had. You would think, oh, the policy, you know, you had Christian fundamentalists, you had Muslim fundamentalists, you had the liberals all together in one coalition. It sounds like a nightmare. How can they agree on anything? The thing they ended up almost splitting up was a toilet. So the deputy mayor from the ACDP wanted to have an ensuite toilet in their office in the civic center. And it would have cost R1 million to repipe the whole thing. And Ziller immediately laughed it off and said, what a ridiculous idea. But because they had created a forum where the small parties got together and spoke about their problems before taking it to a formal coalition management meeting, Ziller was able to find out that, wait, in this meeting, all they're talking about is the toilet and how upset they are that you as the mayor from the DA, as the big party, just dismissed our concerns. And so for weeks, they had to have serious discussions about the viability of a toilet. And she eventually overcame that. But what she told me in our interview was that without having a mechanism like that, where the small parties could feel like they had a voice, the thing would probably have collapsed.
So over a toilet.
Over a toilet. Jeez. And that's what it comes down to in many places.
So basic, yeah.
I have another example you might enjoy of our current situation. So in Nelson Mandela Bay, where, you know, things are tense, one of the issues that I wouldn't say necessarily broke the camel's back but contributed to it was the fact that when the DA sent out letters to their coalition partners, a certain political leader from one of the smaller parties, his name wasn't listed at the top of Dear X, Y, and Z. His name was listed further down on the letter, and that totally infuriated him. And that's the kind
of... dealing with egos here.
Exactly right. You can talk about the policy side, and people often fixate on how will the EFF and the DA compromise on land, which is a legitimate thing. But just as important is how will the personalities of X and Y coalesce together. You know, if it's water and oil, that is something to take very seriously, is what I'm trying to say. Don't think, oh, we've hashed out some policy issues and now we're on track. You have to be very deliberate about creating mechanisms where people can flag these kind of things. So an example is in Kenya, when they had a grand coalition after the election violence in 2007. The leaders from the two respective parties who were governing together both designated their most trusted lieutenants to literally have lunch with each other and cross the road every day and look at things like the letter and say, wait, my guy's not going to be happy that his name is second or third on the list. So you need to have this kind of informal mechanism alongside very formal dispute resolution things. And from the assumption that it's not a question of if we're going to fight, it's a question of when and how often. That's all.
All right. So there's an element of what you've done here that is bound to get you into either trouble or receive more praise, depending on how it goes. You have to do a Nostradamus. You have to be able to forecast. And even in the subtitle, South Africa after the ANC, it kind of has this idea that you are going to portend what's next.
Yeah,
that's a horrible weight, a heavy burden to bear. But is it clear to you? I mean, how murky is it? Because in any prediction situation like this, you have the data, and you've obviously spent a lot of time poring over that. But you also have current affairs.
Yep.
You have these parties, as I said at the beginning of this discussion, sometimes doing self-harm. In the case of the DA in the Western Cape at the moment, some very bad missteps of how they handled the whole Patricia de Lille situation, whether or not she's guilty. We can't determine. The courts, for the first time in a long time, sided against the DA with Patricia de Lille. That must have been an ugly surprise to them. They probably weren't expecting it, having been so successful against the ANC. And then you've got the EFF with Floyd just this week shooting his mouth off about Indian South Africans and how there's no place for them because he sees things in a very racial way, and he sees only black Africans as being the important role players here, and everyone else is kind of to be to be sent off to some other area.
Can't dare say.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't put it past Floyd. I think he probably is a fascist. I mean, Justice Malala said so the other day.
Yeah, I also have no opinion. Fear putting that on the record.
Yeah, I don't know if he's a fascist. I think he's a very dangerous ideologue. And I think he has the ability to persuade lots of people, which makes him very dangerous to the public at large. But who knows what his personal feelings are? It seems to me he's letting them out anyway. And if those aren't his personal feelings, he's certainly not embarrassed to voice them. These parties are not helping themselves.
Yeah.
And as the smaller parties, in a situation where their greatest weapon, Jacob Zuma, is now out of the ANC, and he himself is looking to cause trouble, who's the most vulnerable right now?
Oh, it's a great question. And the prediction question, any honest response at this point from anyone a year out from this election is that we just don't know. It's it's very difficult to say that. But I would argue that that's exactly what's new. Can you imagine a previous election where anyone could credibly say, oh, we don't know if the ANC is going to get 50%?
No.
I think that's the first flag that we need to take seriously.
Okay.
But I'm willing to go further than that. There are a couple of issues, I think, around which this thing is still going to shift. So the fluidity is there. There's no way that a current opinion poll is representative of what's going to happen next year. Things are going to change. South African politics, to me now, are in a state of fluidity that I've never experienced. There's shifting and moving parts every day. I mean, again, Zuma right now is speaking about his plans for the future. Let's put it like that.
Sure.
So maybe take them individually. I think the ANC remains the most vulnerable by virtue of the fact that it is the most divided. I mean, it is divided right down the middle. And there are people with increasingly serious gripes against Ramaphosa, whether they're legitimate or not. Supra clearly has the score to settle. We've heard Magashule saying, you know, we just need to bide our time, then we're going to take back the ANC. Zuma is clearly on an all-out offensive. Mabuza, we don't quite know what his strategy is. So take those things together, and I would say anything that approximates a electoral rebellion in the Northwest, for example, where the EFF has already succeeded in pulling the ANC support down from, I think, around 74% to 59% in one electoral cycle in 2016. If that trend continues, which looks likely based on the by-election results we've seen in places like Kulini and other areas in the Northwest, where the ANC is imploding because of the Supra element and, you know, just... I mean, state collapse.
Sure.
The ANC, I think, remains extremely vulnerable, and we can go back to the structural things we spoke about in the beginning. So they are, to me, the most vulnerable. The DA certainly is in a place that you couldn't have quite imagined 6 months ago. I mean,
how strong is Musi Maimane's hold at the moment? Because he's really got to work very carefully in order to maintain his own reputation at this point, and to be able to control these very disparate elements inside the party.
So I think what's at stake there, is implied is some of the idea of a split, right? So you, if the leader isn't strong enough, then either they get kicked out or some people leave.
Right. Right?
If that's the measure, I don't think that the split is quite as realistic as it feels perhaps sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
The reason I say that is because the DA in the Western Cape, at least, is kind of like the ANC in terms of their dominance. And as we've seen with the ANC, it is exactly the dominance and the access to power which has kept a very ragtag coalition of people together for decades now. I think the same is starting to apply to the DA. And my feeling is the imperative of retaining your power base as a united force and understanding that in an ironic way, it's probably cold outside the DA now, like they used to say about the ANC, I think probably starts to hold true about that party. With Musi and his position, I frankly don't quite understand where he stands in the party and where the and exactly where the power base is. I mean, I don't buy the argument that there's some white Freemasonry society remote controlling Musi Maimane. So, I mean, that's frankly ridiculous to me, but it seems to be the media narrative to a large extent.
Yeah, but then the media in this country are hardly balanced about this stuff either. And if you think about how the EFF have worked the media, puppet.
Yeah.
I mean, there are credible publications, once credible publications, that have become mouthpieces that have aggrandized the EFF's position and status in South African politics to a degree that a party with not even two digits of support in the national parliament would never have been able to achieve before.
So if you think about from the coalition point of view and the possibility of an ANC-EFF coalition and what that would mean for South Africa,
mm-hmm.
I would be extremely nervous based on one interesting data point we have right now, which is that the ANC losing an election at national level would be such a shock that they would be totally desperate, and I'm completely convinced, willing to concede on almost every populist demand of the EFF mm-hmm. in return for the opportunity to remain in power even through a coalition. And the reason I say this is because the way in which the ANC has shifted on the land issue is 6 months ago, it was a non-negotiable fact that the ANC protects Section 25. And here we are today, where the mere threat or suggestion that the EFF is eating into the ANC's support has already enabled that party or incentivized the ANC to capitulate to some extent on this fundamental issue. And to me, that would be very worrying, even if I was an ANC voter, because it shows it's not really about the principle. It is about remaining in power. So that's maybe a bit of a side note on the EFF. And just to finish the point about the DA, I think the key question that we kind of miss from the coalition point of view is it's not really about any specific opposition party.
Yes.
So precisely because we live in a system where once the ANC's dominance goes, no single party is going to replace it. I think the key question about what's happening with the DA is whether the people who previously would have voted for the DA, let's say there's 5% of people who really don't want to vote for the party anymore,
mm-hmm.
but those 5% of people, in my view, are very unlikely to vote for the ANC now. I think the only real question is, do DA voters turn out? And if they turn out, do they vote for the ANC, which seems unlikely, or do they find another opposition party where they can express their unhappiness? And if that happens, and we see the Freedom Front, for example, in some regions growing and perhaps becoming a 3 or 4% party nationally, or COPE making, you know, if I had to wager a surprise bet at this point, Musia Lekota and his party may make a very interesting comeback in next year's election from the, you know, like
that would
zero
be interesting, because he's taken some very strong stands on certain things, right?
And I don't think it's a coincidence that he's been the most outspoken against the land issue, and certainly trying to capitalize on the dissatisfaction with some DA voters and the fear that's coming from the ANC side. So the reason why this is important is it doesn't necessarily matter that there's one opposition party with 30% of the vote. What really matters is if the DA gets 20%, does the 10% go to other opposition parties? Because we know also that the Freedom Front and COPE are not going to go into a coalition with the ANC the first opportunity they get, at least at a national level. So in a way, it can be a healthy thing if people express dissatisfaction as long as they keep voting. I think that's my point. Then the EFF, I think this episode...
Okay, but that you just brought up something really cool that we don't often pay attention to. the number of people who actually vote in South Africa. I mean, it's a minority of people. It's not the majority. The majority of South Africans don't even go to the polls.
Yeah. Well, let's put it like this. The majority of people who are registered do go to the polls, but a majority of people as a whole aren't registered and don't vote.
So don't even care.
That's right. Yeah. So, I mean, I think that's part of the EFF strategy, to be honest. To go back to your question about the different parties, the EFF's problem, in my view, is that it's panicking.
Yeah.
We are seeing its true colors because it is panicking. It feels like the land issue has been kind of taken away from it. I think, ironically, what the EFF might be banking, if I were in their strategic position,
mm-hmm.
I would be banking on, at this point, the ANC changing its mind on the land thing. So for a while, people kind of, here we go again, right? Let's go to next year's election and look back to newspapers from March saying, oh, Julius Malema is about to rejoin the ANC.
Right.
Right. The assumption was the land thing is a done deal. The ANC and the EFF agree. All's well in the world. My suspicion is that probably the EFF at this point is hoping and I think suspecting that the ANC is not going to go all the way. They're not going to create the Marxist dystopia, state-owned, no private property vision, which is the EFF's bottom line. I think the ANC is going to go with some cosmetic changes to the constitution, which will not satisfy Julius Malema. We saw him in parliament last or 2 weeks ago. Getting very angry, and they started chanting their new slogan about, you know, take the land, expropriate, you know, change the
constitution.
Occupation. That's the one. Occupy the land. There we go. And he said quite openly, I think you're going to sell out, Mr. Ramaphosa. And if that happens in August or September, keep an eye on a resurgent EFF. And then suddenly the idea of an EFF-ANC homecoming becomes totally absurd because then the ANC has sold out for the second time, in the words of the EFF. So I think unless something that dramatic happens, and I think it probably will happen because the EFF is desperate. They'll find some way to paint Ramaphosa as a sellout. That and the kind of vulgar fascist race card that they're playing, I think that reveals a kind of desperation where the EFF, I think, is no longer sure that it's going to get that 10 or 12% it was banking on.
Well, it's a hell of a book, and I suggest anyone who has an interest in politics or anyone who is going to be voting, you read this. This is seminal. He's done all the hard work, the heavy lifting for you, and Leon Schreiber hasn't written this book for his health. So
no, certainly not.
Go and pay attention. It is called Coalition Country, South Africa After the ANC. Thank you very much, Leon.
Thanks, Gareth.
Nice to see you.
This is CliffCentral.com.